It's July 21st, 2016. Happy Junk Food Day. Happy Invite an Alien to Live with You Day. And happy Take a Monkey to Work Day. And it's fitting that it's also Donald Trump Day at the Republican National Convention. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Welcome to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. Each week, we check in with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, on the good, the bad, and the ugly that is Harrisburg, PA. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check out all our citizen journalism at RagingChickenPress.org. You can subscribe to Raging Chicken Radio on Podbean, on Stitcher, Google Play Music, and iTunes. Subscribing to Raging Chicken Radio is one of the easiest things that you can do to help support this podcast and all the work we do with Raging Chicken. Raging Chicken turned 5 on July 1st. Woo! You can keep progressive activist media going strong by becoming a member for as little as $2 a month. Our 2016 membership drive is all about preparing for the next 5 years of pull no punches progressive media in PA and beyond. Simply go to RagingChickenPress.org and click Become a Member under the Support and Membership tab. Or if you're listening on Podbean, just click Become a Patron and you'll be on your way. Be sure to check out all the thank you gifts we have for each membership level while you're there. And just a little bit of an update, everybody, if you haven't checked it out already. Last week, we dropped the first episode of The Brewcast. The Brewcast is a audio experimental audio collaboration between Raging Chicken Radio and Binyak Biotech Brews, where we kind of follow the home brewing process from conception to bottling and drinking. So stay tuned for that. We've got some new audio that will be coming up either later this week, the beginning of next week. Some behind the scenes of the actual process of the brewing process, which would be pretty cool. And we've got lots of new content coming up here on Raging Chicken Radio. But today, it is the, we're in the middle, or almost the end, actually, now, of the Republican National Convention, which is just, you know, it's been something, we'll say that. Next week, we got the beginning of the Democratic National Convention. We've got a whole bunch of actions that are coming up and so on. So we got a lot to talk about today. So, Sean, I'm glad you're here today.
Yep, I am enjoying the crazy at the convention.
Well, man, I'll tell you what. So before we get just dive fully into that the land that is Trumpville or whatever the hell they're doing out there in Cleveland, let's kind of go local there for a minute and just kind of take a look at some stuff going on here in Pennsylvania. Then we'll jump into the convention stuff. So I understand that we do have, despite the fact that it's the summer and we don't expect a whole lot out of the Pennsylvania state legislature, they did manage to work on some legislation this past week. Is that correct?
Yes. So as they were breaking last week, I think like literally 10 days ago, they got the budget done and they all left for the summer. The big story was them getting a budget done, you know, in the middle of July and not by, you know, the middle of December, January. But as this was going on, one of the things that happened is the House Bill 1948, the 20-week abortion ban bill, is starting to make its way through the Senate. It was dished into the Senate Judiciary Committee, which I find to be very suspicious, to say the least, given what's been going on.
So suspicious. Why is it suspicious?
Well, Senate, the Judiciary Committee is chaired by State Senator Stuart Greenleaf. Mm-hmm. And, you know, throughout my reporting of this story about House Bill 1948, this bill was introduced as a response to the child sexual abuse bills that were making a way through the House that would actually allow victims of sexual abuse 30, 40 years ago to sue the Catholic Church. And more, they might not be able to sue the Catholic Church or win in court, but they're forcing the Catholic Church to take the stand on the cover-ups of child sexual abuse that's been happening, not only in Philadelphia or Pittsburgh, but all throughout the state, the epidemic that was going on. So this bill... This bill made it through the House, right? The abuse bill made into the Senate Judiciary Committee where Stuart Greenleaf was at. Stuart Greenleaf and his law firm was representing something, was associated with a couple child sexual abuse cases representing the Catholic Church, the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. So he recused himself from that bill when it was in his committee because of his, and it was the first time that's ever happened in probably the state's history, where you have a chair of a committee recusing themselves from a bill, and he allowed that bill to come through to a Senate vote and make it to the Senate floor. So this abortion bill, instead of going to the Health Committee in the Senate, was sent to Stuart Greenleaf's committee, the Judiciary Committee. What does abortion have to do with the Judiciary Committee? Absolutely nothing.
Well, you could, so, unless you argue that it has to do with constitutional rights. I mean that's kind of seems to be a kind of a stretch to me, but
yeah, pretty big stretch.
Yeah.
So as they were breaking, this bill was voted out of the committee 9-5, and is now on its way to the Senate floor. The legislature is going to be on break until the end of September, where they come back, and this bill will potentially make its way to Governor Wolf's desk. So that can make it to the desk. The governor's vowing to veto it, but here's the thing. I don't know if this would happen, but there's a possibility that a special session can be called by the House leader or the Senate leadership to get this bill through after the elections are over or before the elections and pressure Democrats who are part of that God's Guns and Labor caucus in the rural parts of the state, the more conservative parts of the state, to force them to vote for this bill before the elections or after it. And they gave them the veto-proof majority when this
crazy. So let me just kind of run through this now. So now I, on the front end of this bill, right, it looks like, I mean, we don't have evidence that this is the case, right? But at the very least, it looks, let's say, suspicious that you have a senator, right, Greenleaf, or Representative Greenleaf or Senator Greenleaf?
Senator
Greenleaf, right? So you have a senator who's basically seems to be close to the Catholic Church, right, allows this previous bill to go through on sexual predators. But it seems like was this a quid pro quo? Say, you allow this to go through, but then we're going to bring up this abortion bill, right? So there's at least an appearance of that. Whether or not that is the case or not, we don't know that for sure. Is that correct?
No, we did not know that before, but this is highly suspicious.
Exactly.
And there's also Harrisburg. There's a history of horse trading and trading votes.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was getting at. So this looks like it has all the makings, right? At least have one of these kind of backroom deals, horse trading deals that we've seen in Harrisburg before. So that's happening on the front end. Then on the back end, in other words, when this comes out, right? We know, and you've reported on this already, that this bill has not proceeded simply by Republican votes. That you've had these conservative Democrats,
over 20 of them.
Right. So, I mean,
including House leadership,
Pennsylvania, listen up, Pennsylvania, over 20 Democrats,
including House leader Mike Hanna, who is the whip. He's third in line within the Democratic caucus. He voted for this bill, and also a bunch of other Democrats voted for this bill.
Exactly. So listen up, Pennsylvania. You've got over 20 Democrats, right? This is not just a handful of Democrats in the state of Pennsylvania, but you've got over 20 Democrats who have voted for this anti-women's health, anti-abortion bill, and are supporting that. So why is that important? Exactly what Sean said is, like, you know, you can already see the political wheels turning. You got Republicans who in the state are all, you know, they would love to just turn this in the election here in Pennsylvania to stake it on kind of abortion and all those kind of right wing social issues that they love to champion and put it out and force those Democrats who have already shown themselves to be cowards, right, or, you know, closet Republicans, however you want to frame it, have already shown themselves to be cowards and will not defend women's rights, that are going to put them in more pressure to actually stand behind or stand with this anti-abortion, anti-woman bill, and override Wolf's veto of that bill come the fall because we're facing an election. So that's a pretty serious setup.
This, you know, it seems very speculative. There's not enough session days left on the calendar this year for them to override this veto. So if they were to override this veto, it would have to be called in a special session by the House and Senate leaders to do this, which we saw this happen in Texas.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And in the Senate, there is no filibuster. You cannot filibuster in a Pennsylvania Senate. You cannot hold up this bill as long as you possibly can. So as this goes through the 3-day waiting process in the House and then in the Senate, this can easily become law if they wanted to do that. That's an if.
Right.
But
right.
This is Harrisburg, and you can kind of see how things work in this town. And if the Republicans want to ram this through, they will ram it through. either before or after the election.
No, and I think we've talked about this before too. Is like this is where the ifs are important, right? You know, I do not hear you saying that this is exactly what's going on. But, you know, I mean, you've been around the block enough times, you realize that there's patterns to these things, right? And there's patterns not just here in Pennsylvania, but we can see this happening across the country. So it makes sense, right, to pay attention to the patterns, right? Even if it never comes to fruition, it allows people to organize around this stuff to make sure that it doesn't, right?
And the one thing we're seeing, also another thing on this is time. This is the last year, right? This is year two of the session, right? So January 1st, there's a new legislative session, and they would have to go through the process once again for bills that did not become law. Mm-hmm. So the time is against their side. If they wanted to really do this, they would have to do it fast, swift, and through a special, they would have to convene a special session to do this.
Right. And even if they don't get to the point where they can override a veto, right, even if they don't get to that point, right, I think there's the political point to be made that they're using this legislation at the very least like a hammer, right, to try to, you know, force the hand of when it comes to the elections in the fall. Right. Pretty simple.
Exactly.
So, well, okay. So, you know, now that we've established that Pennsylvania has got its own brand of crazy going on here, that we've got enough in our own backyard to take, to take a look at, let's kind of hop a state over there to Cleveland, out in Ohio. Man, this Republican National Convention has been something to behold. I'll admit right off the bat is that I have not been able to keep my attention and follow as closely as I would like, not because of, whatever other excuses. It's because I just can't tolerate watching it after a while. Cause I'm just like, oh my God, I'm just wasting my freaking time. But if you had to kind of like, you know, and I know you've been watching this stuff too, as well, and following this, but, if you had to kind of look for a kind of example, seems to capture the character of what's happening out there in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention, you got any kind of key go-to moments?
Well, I saw a couple Nazi salutes.
Laura Ingraham, right?
Yeah, like, that happened. But I think one of the craziest things that happened the convention didn't even start yet. And you have this representative, Stephen King, coming on MSNBC, and they're talking about race. And Stephen King basically says, what other subgroup of people have contributed to society more than white people? You know, and he's talking about like what group of people have done more for society than white people, going back to like the Romans. Absolutely no one, right? Pretty much. Right. And I'm just like, I'm just like, holy shit. Like, and Chris Hayes had to stop. You saw the video, right?
Yes.
Chris Hayes, I think, did a good job like saying we are not debating this on national TV right now. What I think they should have had that debate. But I mean, as the moderator, he was probably thrown off by that. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and he was just like, no, we're not opening up this can of worms right now on live TV. And which, I mean, like the people were absolutely shocked seeing the face on Charlie Pierce and the African-American lady sitting at the table. Mm-hmm. She was just like, her jaw drop when he said that.
Yeah.
And like, I shot a tweet out that got some good traction. Why does the GOP hate Muslims? Well, they invented math. Like,
no, exactly.
I mean, like what, okay. So like what groups of like, you know, most of our science comes from Islam. It comes
It comes out of the Middle East and Islamic culture. It's just gunpowder comes from China, right?
Yeah, like someone shot a tweet out there. If it wasn't for the Chinese, there would not be a Second Amendment in the United States.
That's a pretty straight line, right?
I mean, like,
no, if it went ahead, you know, and you make the argument too as well. You know, if it hadn't been for the Chinese, if it hadn't been for the Chinese, then basically, there would have been no American Empire or British Empire for that matter. And the folks over there in the UK would still be, you know, like eating boiled meat because that's the best that they could do. You know, I mean, seriously, I mean, it was unbelievable hearing him say that. But I got to push back at you a little bit here too. I was like, I don't know if I want to give Chris Hayes that much credit. I mean, I see what he tried to do, but when I watched that, I was like, How are you not taking this guy to task?
Yeah.
How are you not basically saying this is completely not supported? Instead, what I saw that as his an attempt to tamp down that argument. Right. And I was like, whoa, because he kept on saying, no, we're not going to debate that. We're not going to debate that. I'm like, well, then where do we debate this? Right. If you've got this guy who's coming out here as a Republican surrogate, you know, kind of supporting Trump,
a guy who has a Confederate flag sitting on his desk, congressional office.
Yeah. In my mind, that is the time to push back on that thing. But, you know, I kept on reading that as, you know, and MSNBC basically purged a bunch of its kind of, you know, liberal commentators and program hosts, right, over the past several years. Right. And now all you have left is Rachel Maddow, Chris Hayes, and, you know, Chris Matthews, who is by no stretch of the imagination a progressive. Right. That's who you have. And you got Brian the freaking Williams there. Right, who is just a waste of a suit in my mind when it comes to news reporting. But, you know, I saw that as a reflection of MSNBC's new brand, right, that it is no longer going to take people to task, that it's going to play the game like everyone else all through this
election. CNN light, pretty much.
Yeah, you know, and actually Rachel Maddow made a really good point in some of her other coverage is that, you know, it's like, why is it? Oh, well, actually, she made this a small point. Sam Cedar's actually the one, right, for the Majority Report, who really dug into this and said, you know, the reason why the Melania Trump speech, you know, we haven't even talked about that yet, but the Melania Trump speech, you know, the plagiarism of Michelle Obama speech became such a big deal for national media, right, was precisely because it was a process issue and it wasn't an ideological issue or a political issue, right? So they could dig into that as a big controversy. Meanwhile, you've got freaking, you know, racism run amok on the stage, right, without comment, right? And I thought that was one of the most stark contrasts. What we saw, the mainstream media coverage of this has been astoundingly horrific, right?
Yeah, that's
and bring it just as, you know, let's look at the props of the stage. How was the stage set up? Was there any stutters in the speech? I mean, the mark of a good speech is whether or not, like, they fumbled over words. I mean, it's really crazy.
I know. One of the things, like, I have not watched any MSNBC this week. The only where I've been, the only convention coverage I've got when I was off out of work has been coming from the Young Turks, who they've done a really great job in covering this convention, and the Majority Report with Sam Cedar. And pretty much, like, I don't watch MSNBC anymore. I used to watch it. I grew up watching Oberman. I remember being in high school during the Iraq War, during that debacle, and every day Keith Oberman would say, so-and-so day since mission accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you know, every day Keith Oberman, probably one of the reasons why I'm a little, you know, as liberal has, like, just because of, like, his commentary. Mm-hmm. And now to see where that has gone, that organization, they just want to become CNN light. And it really shows you that there is no willingness to have a liberal news source on on cable TV.
No, that's
not
true.
And you saw what happened with Al Jazeera America. Mm-hmm. I think they gave up on that way too early. I think that Al Jazeera America should have been sharing their videos online. They should have been putting that stuff on Facebook and social media. I think there's parts of that, but it's also Comcast not giving them access to any of the primetime channel numbers. You basically had to have digital cable in order to watch Al Jazeera America. Mm-hmm. You weren't able to watch it on your basic cable in the high 100s.
No, but here's a couple things to say about that with the Al Jazeera situation, right? And I think that, you know, Zach Roberts, you know, he's a photojournalist who works for Greg Palast and things like this. We had him at Kutztown University for a citizen media forum last year. Is that, you know, he made a really good point when he was out at Kutztown, is that, you know, the thing was, he's like, okay, yeah, everyone would champion Al Jazeera on the left, right? You know, liberals on the left say this is, you know, this, they're doing great reporting, they're good reporting, which was absolutely true. Right. But he would say is like, how many of you actually watch them on TV as opposed to watching their stuff on social media? Right. And the fact was is that most of their traffic came through social media. And yes, there's reasons for that, just like you laid out. But his point with that, too, as well, is that, you know, on the left and progressives in general, we have a very poor track record of actually supporting those kind of programs that we say we want. Right. We want it for free. right, when it comes right down to it. And the thing is that in order for Al Jazeera to succeed, right, it needed some sort of rating bumps in its in that cable market, right? And it just wasn't getting them, right? Most of their traffic was coming through social media and all that kind of stuff. But when it comes to funders, right, funders really are still at that point where they're not caring so much about it. So, you know, again, go back and forth. You got, you know, the Prince of Dubai, whatever, you know, all these, you know, the people kind of behind Al Jazeera and all this stuff kind of looking at that and saying, well, okay, this is not performing, so we're just going to have to shut it down. You know, they've kept some of their online stuff, right?
AJ Plus.
AJ Plus, which is still, I think, phenomenal. Right. But, you know, this goes to exactly the point is that, you know, MSNBC was the one holdout. And, you know, and I go back and forth and have arguments with myself every night about MSNBC because I can't, it turns my stomach. But, you know, I feel it's kind of like, you know, part of what I do when I watch MSNBC is to say, okay, if you were to take, you know, the liberal end, right, of cable news right now, right, what is it, right? It's still probably MSNBC. I am not saying they're liberal, but I'm saying if you given the existing spectrum, where is it? And using that as a benchmark, because and why that's important for me, at least, right, when I'm looking at, you know, the kind of work that we're doing here with Raging Chicken, the kind of, you know, thought I'm thinking about, you know, the future of journalism in this country and so on, I want kind of a marker, right? And I get the marker with MSNBC, and you've watched that marker, just like the Democratic Party did, move consistently to the right. And now, like, you have some basic common sense stuff that is being reported, like, you know, again, Sam Cedar, Young Turks, Rick Smith Show did some great coverage out there in Cleveland, too, as well. I mean, all these folks are coming out here, and those voices are so far removed and so contrary to what we're seeing on something like MSNBC. It shows you how far that, you know, the MSNBC has kind of shifted. And I would say that I don't even think they're after CNN Lite. I think in their minds, what they're after, they're saying, well, look, CNN is no longer CNN. Right, CNN is just kind of like a waste of time. So we're going to try to fill in that gap. It's like the same kind of stuff that we've seen for the Democratic Leadership Council to say, okay, hey, let's move a little bit to the right and kind of grab some of these voters over here. Meanwhile, more and more progressives and liberals are being left behind. So my point of saying all that is simply this, is that all the more reason, right, that we need to kind of invest in this in kind of our progressive media infrastructure. Because, look, these folks are leaving us behind. So anyways, end of rant on that one.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And it amazes me, the blatant racism coming out of the convention, and exactly what we were just saying. The only place that's getting covered is on social media, is on Twitter, and it is on, you know, through the Young Turks or through the Majority Report. You don't see MSNBC or any other one calling out this blatant racism that's going on up there. I mean, like, the stuff that Trump has been saying, like, that has come out yesterday. A Washington Post reported that Trump was reportedly saying, you know, black people are lazy, not by choice, but by trait.
Right.
I mean, like, and no one is talking about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's astounding to me that, like, Steve King was allowed to get away with that garbage, right, on national TV, right, even without being challenged at all on that claim, without some, like, half-hearted kind of like, oh, please don't explode this, please let me keep my job, Chris Hayes' response to it. But
yeah.
And you know, the other thing I want to say too, as well, is like, that whole, the Laura Ingraham thing, right, with the whole kind of like, you know, the Nazi salute thing that she does there, right, that Laura Ingraham thing, is that when I first saw it, I was like, holy crap, right? And then, you know, okay, then you see, then she does these other waves afterwards. She's like, okay, which is just kind of a weird angle or something like this, right? Because most of the memes and most of the images that I originally saw were kind of just images of her right after she concludes her speech. But there's this one, it was published in Crooks and Liars. So anybody who's out there listening, you check this one out. It's a Crooks and Liars that says, who better than Laura Ingraham to fly the Nazi salute at the RNC, by Karoli Kunz. Check that article out, because it's got a Getty's image picture up there, which made it all the more stark, right? In this one, the camera is pulled back a lot more. It's not just on Laura Ingraham.
You see the portrait of Trump?
And you see, basically, Trump is on the screen, right, with his arm raised in, you know, he's probably waving, right? But, you know, it looks kind of like that same kind of salute. And when she does that, she's facing him doing that, right? So she turns to the image of him and does that salute thing. And then she pulls her arm back a little bit, waves to the rest of the crowd. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me, right? It just made it worse, right? Because part of when I see things like that is like, you know, so, okay, look, how much of this is kind of, you know, attempts at political rhetoric, right, where you're trying to kind of use the image to cast light on what's actually happening there at the convention, right? And, you know, using a particular picture in order to accomplish a particular end. So I'm like, yeah, okay, is this, you know, how stark is this and how much of this is just about cropping the picture and stuff? And then when I saw the Getty image pulled back, I'm like, oh my God, this is unbelievable. You know, and I love some of the, my favorite commentary on that was like, you know, the moment you forget that your Klan rally is on national television.
And like, I know, like, I'm about to go off on another tangent here, but
yeah, go.
One of the things coming out of here, I am a huge fan of Chris Hedges. I've been reading Chris Hedges for 8 or 9 years now. And one of the things he's been talking about that no one has been talking about is this authoritarianism on the right and how it's rising. And it's scary to see what's happening. This blatant authoritarianism, this Donald Trump is not going to be a Democratic leader. The things have been, the media is finally saying some of the things where Chris Christie said he's going to purge all of the Obama loyalists when Trump becomes president.
Used that word, right?
Yeah. Not people who are civil servants. But it's basically a purity test within the federal government they're going to do. And all these other things. Like, Trump is a strong man. He is a dictator. And he's been saying things, well, if the army's not going to listen to me, I'm going to force them to do something like that. I mean, you actually have The Atlantic or other big established magazines now saying, no, a coup in the United States would actually be possible with Donald Trump becoming president. Mm-hmm. Just think about that because of his authoritarianism. Like, he's so authoritarian, so much of an authoritarian, people are already talking about, no, this guy can get thrown out of office through a coup.
No,
how crazy is that?
Yeah, I want to underscore what the point that you said. This is an article from Vox, right? This was just published yesterday, right? On the point you just made about Chris Christie, right? I want to give people context for that. This is not just hearsay. So I'm going to read this kind of these two paragraphs. It's the opening two paragraphs here. It says, the general election, this is an article by Dylan Matthews. It says, the general election is still more than 3 months away, but the Donald Trump campaign, at least, is getting a jump start on the transition planning. And transition chief Chris Christie has some big ideas for how to make the federal bureaucracy great again. Reuters' Emily Flitter reports that Christie told a donor meeting on Tuesday that Trump will try to purge the government of Obama appointees out of, quote, fear that Obama may convert these appointees to civil servants who have more job security than officials who have been politically appointed, unquote. To make the process easier, Christie reportedly said, quote, one of the things I have suggested to Donald is that we have to immediately ask the Republican Congress to change the civil service laws, because if they do, it will make it a lot easier to fire those people, unquote. Right. So this is not in question. This is something that Christie actually said.
And this was recorded at a private meeting. This is what they're talking about behind closed doors.
Exactly.
And that's really scary. I mean, like, you think of, like, your history with Stalinist purges from government, or what's happening right now, that fake coup in Turkey, and how the academics are getting purged, the military's getting purged, and Erdogan is controlling this vast right-wing nationalist movement in Turkey. You know, like, this is the type of stuff it has me scared for the first time. Like, you know, Romney, yeah, okay, he's a businessman. He's not going to really rock the boat. He's going to be an establishment leader. I mean, he would be a bad president, right? If Romney would have won in 2012. But what's scary with this is we have someone who's a blatant nationalist. He's running a racist campaign. He's running a white supremacist campaign. He's running on it. He's getting the support of nationalists and all this other thing that's going on, and it's mirroring what is happening in Europe right now. We are watching this fascist movements grow in England, Germany, France with Le Pen, in Turkey, in Greece,
Italy.
We are watching these fascist nationalist movements get national attention in these countries in Europe, where it's supposed to be the bastion of liberal democracy and social democracy. And now we're watching this happen here in the United States. That's what's really scary. And that has me scared to the core to think about we have a group of people who are white nationalists who are conservatives, and they believe in having an authoritarian government like this.
No, I look
and everything against freedom, liberty, and democracy.
Exactly, but frankly, I think that the fact that say you and others, right, that are scared now is a good thing. As long as that fear doesn't lead us down, the road of inaction, right? Because I think if anything is that, I've been saying this for a while now that, liberals need to wake the frick up, right? I mean, do not take this guy for granted, right? And I know that if you look at the polling state by state and things like this, it still looks like Hillary Clinton has got a fairly good chance, right, of making it to the presidency, right? If you not just these national like opinion polls, but when you actually start breaking it state by state and actually look at how our elections are run, it looks like heavily on Hillary's side. But to take that for granted is crazy. And to think this guy is dumb, to think his campaign is dumb just because he barely has a campaign is again misses the point, right? There's a reason why Donald Trump does not have a huge campaign, right? He wants it all like this. The fact that he's been on the stage so many times already shows you that he wants you to see it like this. And this is, I don't know if other people have talked about this already, but this is my thought on what happened with Ted Cruz last night, right? Because for those of you who may not have seen what goes on, Ted Cruz went out there. He was supposed to speak for, 10 minutes or something like that. He went for 23, spoke very slowly. A lot of the reporting on it was like, yeah, this was like thumb in a nose at Donald Trump. And at the end of the speech, after saying, we need to get out there and all this kind of stuff, he did not endorse Donald Trump, okay? And there were boos. There were like yelling and hissing at Cruz, like, how dare he get up there? And they started yelling, Trump, 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 we love Trump, we love Trump. And they basically booed him off the stage. And then Donald Trump kind of came out to get some cheers to him, right? In my mind, I looked at that and I was like, this is all orchestrated, right? This was about taking down Ted Cruz, taking down the opposition within the Republican Party, because this is why the first comments that came out from like the prognosticators online, on cable news were like, oh my God, how could they? This shows how bad his campaign is. They didn't know he was going to do this. But the embargoed speech, right, the copy of Cruz's speech had been released an hour before it was given to the media. Now, they couldn't report on it until after he'd given it. That's the embargoed speech. In that embargoed speech, what it was written in that speech, there was no endorsement. It was what Cruz said, right? So that means the people on the Trump side knew what he was going to say. So that's number one. Number two is that very early on in the convention, everyone thought it was very odd that New York and California, right, were the two states that were up front by the stage, right? Because New York and California are not, as everybody knows, Republican strongholds. Right. So usually they're somewhere back in the middle and things like this. They're fairly large delegation. But he put the New York delegation right in front of the stage. Right. And when it got to that point where Cruz did not endorse, right, it was almost on cue. The New York delegation started yelling, right, started booing him down, catcalling him, basically going after him right on stage, and which started the rest of the yelling and screaming and the booing. So I'm like, holy crap. This was like a public takedown of Ted Cruz, right, at this thing, because Trump did not seem all that bothered by the fact that Cruz didn't give that. It was the Republican and reporter after reporter that reported what happened on the floor there said it was one of the first times the entire convention that they felt a whole bunch of energy behind Donald Trump at that moment. And that's the kind of crap that scares me. Because that points to something that's calculating, and he's going to take down the opposition, whether it's kind of like, through his, tweeting and all that kind of stuff, or it's for this kind of showmanship where you're going to take him down in public.
He gored them in public pretty much. Machiavelli.
That I look at that, and that's what I saw. I have no basis for that reading other than putting these pieces together and kind of look at what happened and look at the Trump campaign's response to that. And it just that's the kind of stuff that gave me some shivers. I'm like, wow, you bring Cruz up there because everyone says that Cruz is not an idiot, right? He's a smart guy. He's a horrible human being, but he's smart and calculating, right? If you get Cruz, you lay a trap for Cruz like that. Right. That's something.
Well,
right?
Do you think Cruz knew what was going to go? Do you think Cruz knew what was going to happen? And he just said, screw it. I'm going to go out there and do this anyway, regardless of what they think.
No, I think Cruz, here's what I think happened, right? I think Cruz thought that he was getting the better end of the deal. Right? I think Cruz went out there thinking like, okay, Trump is going to lose this election horrendously, right? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to claim the conservatives for me so I can start building my conservative base like for the next round of elections when we're going to need a Republican candidate. I think this was Cruz's way of kind of thinking about transition. I think the only thing that got him to that stage was his own ego in believing that he could, that he was the great one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. And I think that the Cruz thinks that Trump is dumb, and he thought he pulled one over on Donald Trump, that he was going to be able to go out there and be able to do whatever hell he wanted. I mean, why else would the Trump campaign let him go on for an extra 13 minutes, right? You know, I mean, I thought that was a telling moment. If that's what was going on. I mean, now, you know, again, like I said, this is my reading of things. But it's pretty spectacularly crazy. But listen, we've gone way on. So listen, we're gonna come up to a break, and the fun doesn't stop here, folks. Because when we come back after the break, next week is the Democratic National Convention right here in Philadelphia, right down the road. And there's a lot of stuff going on. Starting with Sunday, there's a march for a clean energy revolution in Philadelphia ahead of the DNC. A bunch of protests that are coming up. So we're going to turn our attention to the DNC after this break. And, you know, I was going to remind everybody, too, as well, you know, like we were talking about before, if there's any good reason to get out there and support progressive media, support the work that we do here at Raging Chicken Press, support your favorite kind of progressive podcast or news site or things like this, please do. But you can become a member of Raging Chicken Press simply by going to RagingChickenPress.org, click on the support and membership tab, and click on become a member. You can become a member for as little as $2 a month. If you're listening on Podbean, just click on that little button that says become a patron. It'll take you right to that site. We got some free gifts for you and that kind of stuff for becoming a member, and we really, really appreciate your support. But we're going to need a powerful media structure moving forward. So come on out. Anyways, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be back right after this break. More with Sean Kitchen. We'll talk about the DNC. Be back right after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1931, and Chicago public school teachers went home without a paycheck. The school system was broke. Property owners out of work due to the Great Depression could not pay their property taxes, which were used to fund the public schools. Schools in inner cities lacked libraries, playgrounds, and often even adequate toilet facilities. Classrooms were overcrowded. Black teachers faced racial discrimination. School administrators piled on more clerical work onto teachers' already busy workloads. They introduced a blizzard of standardized tests. Still, according to an article published in 1927 in the American Teacher magazine, teachers were supposed to believe that teaching was a noble profession, free and immune from the cares of the more sordid world. The same article went on to say that many teachers, quote, believed their personal dignity and self-respect required that they keep aloof from any organization affiliated with labor. The Great Depression made teachers more militant. However, Chicago teachers stayed on the job despite the payless paydays. One Chicago teacher explained that they were determined not to desert the Chicago schools. It was not easy organizing Chicago's teachers. Only 10% of the teachers belonged to the four competing teachers' unions. But not getting paid helped arouse them. And 2 years later, 5,000 teachers converged on Chicago's largest banks in protest. They broke windows and overturned desks. Chicago's mayor, Ed Kelly, agreed to pay 4 of the 9 months back pay owed to them. Finally, in 1934, thanks to federal assistance, the Chicago teachers received all of their back pay. You only need read about the current Chicago teachers' struggle to see that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. Each week, we check in with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly that is Harrisburg, PA. And, you know, across the country, too, as well. So, you know, in our first half, we went way long talking about the Republican National Convention out there in Cleveland. And, you know, God, I think we could have gone on forever because so much was going on out there. But as the Republican National Convention comes to a close today, with the inauguration of King Donald. We will be shifting our attention to the Democratic National Convention, which will start next Monday. And we're expecting to get an announcement from Hillary Clinton as early as tonight about her vice presidential running mate. My money is on Tim Kaine from Virginia. I think she's going the Democratic Leadership Council's centrist road. But that's just my opinion on it. We'll see what happens. But next week, it's going to be there's not going to be only a lot happening inside the convention, right? For my money, some of the best reason for getting down to Philly is what's happening outside the convention. So beginning this Sunday, for example, we have the March for a Clean Energy Revolution. That is being held. It's going to start at noon, and people are going to meet at the Philadelphia City Hall. And the argument is to ban fracking, right? Keep fossil fuels in the ground, stop dirty energy, environmental justice for all, and a just transition to 100% renewable. It's being sponsored by Americans Against Fracking, but there's like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of groups that have signed on, including our organization, Raging Chicken Press, in support of the march. And I will be in Philadelphia for that march on Sunday, covering those events. So stay tuned. We're going to be doing some Facebook live feeds from on the ground, from the protest there in Philadelphia. Hopefully, we're going to be getting some interviews with some folks. So stay tuned with that. So that's the launch. That's the day before the Democratic National Convention takes place. But Sean, you know, I also understand we were talking about this during the break, too, as well, that this is not the only action that's going on outside the Democratic National Convention. There's a bunch of course, tons of protests that will be happening outside the convention, especially those folks associated with the Bernie Sanders campaign. This is not like officially sanctioned Bernie Sanders stuff, but these are movement people that will be outside pushing that Democratic Party towards a kind of more progressive end and kind of, helping to build a movement. But there's also people right there down in Philadelphia that are standing up for their rights that looks like they may put, raid on some people's parades down there in Philadelphia if people don't get their act together at the Philadelphia airport. So what's going on down there, Sean?
So this is a flight that's been going on for a few years now. The Philadelphia International Airport uses a lot of contracted workers to do baggage and stuff like that, subcontractors. And these subcontractors have been organizing for the past couple of years, especially with the Flight for 15 movement. SEIU 32BJ is heavily involved with this. For those of you who don't know, 32BJ is in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and New York. They usually just they're janitors, maintenance people, usually in public schools and airports and stuff like that, where you have like a lot of public servants. Security guards, they do a lot of organizing. And I think next week I know that they're probably going to have a strike at the airport. They've already had a massive action down there this week where hundreds of people stage a sit-in outside of the terminal entrances, completely screwing up the traffic in that area. For those of you who don't know Philadelphia International Airport, it's pretty cramped area to get your car to get in and get out, to get into the area to check in for your flights. And next week they plan on they're going to go on strike, and good for them. One of the things that, you know, I've been saying this for a while, this is a continuance of the Occupy movement. This is where we're now seeing more radical unionism, more radical actions taken by the left. And it's encouraging seeing these actions going on. I've been to plenty of environmental rallies over the past few years. Went to one in DC when I was an intern out here in Harrisburg 3 years ago. I was able to go to the massive march in New York City a couple years ago, where 500,000 plus people showed up at Central Park and marched all the way down to one of the biggest marches that I've ever been a part of in my life. It's great. I think we're seeing a time that the left is going to be organizing. And I think this is just another step in that direction.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I think, you know, not just Occupy, but, you know, the whole Fight for 15 movement, which, of course, is also connected to, you know,
the Black Lives Matter movement and
all this kind of stuff. Like, so, for example, and you can see those intersections happening right now. So there was a huge demonstration on Tuesday, like Sean was talking about. And there was this enormous banner that they held out in front of them that said, "Respect Black Workers." Right. So, I mean, there you see this kind of intersection of what, you know, the kind of Fight for 15 movement, which, of course, SEIU is kind of actively involved in, the Fight for 15 movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, and, you know, and this tactic of occupying, right, occupying space. And, you know, just the militancy of those workers, the All Walmart campaign is another one that comes to mind, the militancy of those workers kind of coming up and the willingness to disrupt business as usual, you know, and not, I think it's also significant that, you know, the vote was overwhelmingly for the vote took place on July 12th, right, in support of a strike for this week. And it was, you know, the fact that it's taking place at the Democratic National Convention. I mean, sure, it's in Philadelphia and so on, but their willingness to disrupt the Democratic National Convention is because, you know, basically the Bernie Sanders campaign and the movements that have come out of that and the Black Lives Matter movement have opened up some rifts in the Democratic Party. And they're seeking to kind of push on those rifts and move that party in a progressive way. Or, you know, who knows? I mean, down the road, this might be, you know, the birth of, you know, a new kind of political form here in the U.S.
No, and it's great, you know, back in 2012, in the spring, the fall of 2012, Chicago teachers went on strike, and a lot of liberals on the left were denouncing the strike. How could you do this during an election time with the Rahm Emanuel being how can you do this with Rahm Emanuel being the mayor of Chicago and with Obama running? Shame on you. You know, now 4 years later, 3.5 years later, we are now at a point where we're not playing politics anymore. We're taking out into the streets and we're continuing to do this. And we're going to still do this until we get what we want or until we get what's best for the society as a whole.
No, I'd agree. And we've talked about this on the program before, is that, you know, we've seen this move in the Democratic Party, you know, beginning before Bill Clinton, right? But where the Democratic Party really walked away from its historic connection to labor and the working class, beginning, you know, in the 70s and 80s and so on. It's been documented, you know, in a whole bunch of publications and stuff. And I've been, you know, following this history really interesting because basically what the Democrats did kind of, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, they basically said, OK, we've got kind of labor unions secured and kind of the working class is, you know, going to vote for us. So we're going to start courting these kind of young kind of professionals, primarily white professional, more upper class. And we saw the issues that the Democrats championed. Were those that were more in line with that kind of emerging professional class. But that doesn't mean that, you know, workers have gone away. Labor has still been one of the strongest supporters of the Democratic Party, especially when it comes to organizing, door knocking, and getting out the vote. But that's been an increasing, you know, fraught relationship as the Democrats have supported these, you know, anti-worker trade bills, have gotten down behind austerity, have tried to break up teachers' unions in favor of charter schools and privatization of public schools. So that rift is growing. And I think now we're seeing this kind of explosion of energy on the left of the labor movement, going right back to your point, which you said about the militancy of the labor movement. We've seen that explosion, which is actually, you know, coming back and saying, no, we're not dead. As a matter of fact, we've taken it on the chin just one too many times and we've had enough. And the thing is that the constituencies that are forming this new militancy, right, are not the same kind of labor constituencies that are in labor leadership. So there's tensions within the labor movement itself, right, from the kind of, you know, the bureaucracy or, you know, and I don't mean that necessarily a negative word, but the leadership, the institution itself of labor, all right, and where the grassroots militancy is, right? And I think that is only a good thing for the left and a good thing for the labor movement.
And I think it's a really good thing that 32BJ is doing this. I've met Gabe Morgan a handful of times at rallies, and it's great seeing a labor leader like that, the president of 32BJ, sitting down in the front of these actions and getting arrested with the people he's organizing. I think a lot of applause should go out to go out to Gabe Morgan for what he's been doing with 32BJ. I mean, he's just a local local leader for this union, but he's willing to go out there on the grassroots level. He's with the grassroots, and we need more labor leaders like that to start doing that. And you know, it's unfortunate the PFT hasn't done that. I mean, they've been out there, but they're still without a contract, over a thousand days with no contract.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're probably going to be out there protesting. We're talking about the previous segment. You know, we're hitting a boiling point with this nationalism and authoritarianism, but we're also on the left seeing just as equal. We're seeing just as a radical shift to the left.
That's right.
Like we are, the center is breaking right now. I think people are saying the center cannot hold. No, the center is broken. People are running to their ideological positions. And it's finally good seeing, you know, back when the Tea Party, quote unquote Tea Party, or the base overtook the Republican Party in 2010, people are saying, well, how come this is not happening on the left? And it is at that time. But now we're seeing that pendulum swinging back to the left, where they are getting out ahead of issues. They're becoming more militant than ever. And it's great seeing these actions happening. I know, like, the left has been there and they've been protesting against the war, or they've been protesting, you know, the free trade of the Americas and stuff like that. But the fact that you had Black Lives Matter marches a week, every night for a week after the recent round of shootings, you have this organizing going on with the Black Lives Matter, with the Fight for 15 workers, with the Occupy movement. I mean, these are people from the Occupy movement in these movements going out. And it's, you know, I think we're building that base of progressive issues later on down the line. You know, this is not an election issue. Yes, elections matter, but the movement will not go away after the first Tuesday, November.
No, I agree. And I think this is one of the most encouraging things about these movements. One is to see the character of the labor movement that is involved in this kind of resistance and building social movements, because basically, like any institution, many labor unions, the leadership of labor unions, right, and some of the national federations and even state federations, the AFL-CIOs and so on, they begin to kind of settle into a particular kind of comfort zone, and if you talk to rank and file workers who are energized and who are activists, they'll tell you this, right? And they get frustrated with their local leadership or the statewide leadership, because those leaders tend to see politics and political action through kind of managing PR campaigns, advertisements, and lobbying in the capitals, right? Where labor's power has always come from activated members, organized members, right, who are willing to strike, who are willing to organize, and willing to kind of build the movement outside this, you know? And, you know, like any institution, labor has got to be taught a lesson every once in a while that you are just going to facilitate your own demise unless you are actually organizing your members and, getting back to the roots of what brought us labor to begin with. So you've got that on the one side, because, you know, one of the things that labor has done better than any other institution in my mind, right? Labor understands the practical long-term benefits of organizing and keeping an institutional history alive, right? So for example, you've got a steel workers organizing manual, right? Which was, here's your basic, which hasn't changed a ton, right? Since back in the 1930s and stuff, about what it means to organize stuff, right? And passing from generation to generation about building that movement and kind of keeping those institutions alive, right? Too often what's happened since the 1960s is the left have seen organizing as kind of like, you gather for this big march and you kind of like talk about your issues and things like this, but you don't really pay a whole lot of attention about building a movement from generation to generation. And there was a time which labor really, really understood that. They tended to fade away. And now this new, more militant labor union movement is beginning to understand that. That is phenomenal. On the other hand, what came out of Occupy to a certain degree, but what we're seeing, especially in Black Lives Matter, is that we're seeing people that are building new movements that are, you know, there's intersections with the labor movement, certainly, but they've independent movements, but the also understanding the absolute essential character of building those movements, establishing institutions, establishing practices, establishing strategy, right? That is incredibly encouraging, right? And this is where, you know, I think that there's going to be a lot of room for those folks who were supporting Bernie Sanders. Of course, you've got the Bernie or bust people who just want to say, oh, blah, 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 the way I'm going to vote for Hillary, right? Shillery, whatever you want to call her, right? Totally, as you were kind of talking about before, totally misunderstanding what it means to build social movements, right? If they thought this was only about an election to begin with, well, guess what? They are already lost, right? This is about building a movement, because this election is one blip, right, on the calendar of social movements and political change. So what you see in the Black Lives Matter movement is just really amazing. And you've seen this escalation of tactics, as escalation of strategy. And, you know, right from the get-go, they've been clear about what they're after, right? This is not like, you know, the criticisms of the Occupy movement, which, like, they didn't have a platform. Black Lives Matter, they've got a platform, right? They've got concrete issues that they're going to push for, and they're pushing for big social change too as well. And I think there's a bunch of folks that have come out of Occupy who have understand that too as well. So you've got amazing groups or constituencies out there that are going to be outside that convention hall, which is why Raging Chicken Press is going to be there to cover some of that stuff. But
and also
it's exciting, I'm telling you.
May I add on this Sunday, there's also going to be another action going on. For those of you who have not been paying attention to what's happening locally in North Philadelphia, Temple has been planning on building
a
football stadium that would displace a lot of poor people, poor African Americans in that part of North Philadelphia, to have a football stadium that's not going to really do much for the university. It might do stuff for their program, but it will not do much for the university. And the Socialist Alternative and the Temple Socialist students have been organizing the neighborhood, you know, not just organizing students, they're organizing members of the community, letting them be aware of this, that they do not want this. They are bringing in Keshwana Savant from Washington State to speak to the community members, you know, bringing in a socialist city councilwoman to talk against the stadium. And it's also one of the things I am happy to see. I am happy to see that there's an actual socialist push within our communities now. Yep. You know, like, Pennsylvania has a steep history of socialism, of socialist mayors running our cities back in the 20s and 30s. You know, and it's great seeing that there's not just like, oh, I identify myself as a socialist. I am a, you know, registered Democrat, but my political views are socialist leaning. And it's great seeing these organizations finally organizing, not just like getting up together in some anarchist bookshop in Philadelphia and talking about, you know, big picture Marxism or, you know, Zizek or like other, you know, communist writers. You know, they're actually finally going out in the communities, making that fight for 15, pushing and pushing and pushing, and actually sticking a flag out in the far left saying, no, we will not move from these issues. And we're bringing the other groups with us. You know, the Socialist Alternative was one of the first groups to get out there with the 15 and say, no, we're not moving. And locally, everyone wanted 10 an hour. Now the unions and everyone else are demanding 15 an hour because of that organizing by these small community groups like the Socialist Alternative in Philadelphia and other parts around the country.
Absolutely. And you know what's interesting too is, like, not only do you have this kind of movements, and you see, you know, and again, this is one of the results of the Bernie Sanders campaign. I mean, the fact that, you know, I'm not saying that Bernie Sanders caused Socialist Alternative, them, they've been around for a while, but he made some political space, right, for these ideas to come into the kind of a much more public space, not as this kind of radical fringe thing, but people actually getting things done. I mean, look, we've got, you know, people from Social Alternative being elected to office, right? I mean, this is new. And I would say that it's not insignificant, right? I think it's very, very important for all this that we've got, you know, Jacobin, right? Jacobin, the magazine, Jacobin, the online show, Jacobin. Well, let me say this about Jacobin. Why Jacobin is so important in particular, right, is because it is, one, it's a voice that that reflects this kind of new movement, right, this kind of new socialist perspective. It's connected to the history, absolutely, right? But they are not, like, that magazine is not about, like, staking a flag and saying, we are this brand of socialism and, you know, against these other kinds. And it's not like that. right? It's about a socialism that understands organizing, about movement building and ideas and the connections between them. That's so amazing. In These Times, another great one, right? In These Times has been around for a long time, right? And they've had a long kind of history of kind of focusing on activism, focusing on labor issues and so on. They're phenomenal. So there's, I mean, we can, Labor Notes, for example, has been around, got us for as long as I remember, about, you know, rank and file militant labor activism. And they've been around. Jacobin, however, has they have caught fire within, I think, an emerging and a kind of, especially kind of a younger group of folks who are now see the kind of importance of ideas connected to practice. So, that's, you know, kudos to them as part of this as well.
And also, it's like to say thank you to my mom and her union membership with the SEIU. Last week, I got my first free issue of In These Times. It's a 1-year subscription. In These Times was running a promotion. If you're a union member, you can get a free subscription to this magazine for the year. And yes, I will admit it. I use my mom's union. You know, she's a member of 32. No, the SEIU. She's an SEIU member, and I used her membership to get, you know, for me to keep up on these things. And the first issue was an introduction to socialism with Bernie and Hillary on the front cover.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. I mean, so, you know, I mean, there's a lot of exciting things that are going on, which is all the more reason that we need to pay attention to this stuff. So before, I want to talk just a little about kind of, you know, do some of the insider stuff on the convention first, but just want to make people know, let people know that if you are interested in the actions that are going down in Philly, like, first of all, you can just kind of look up, say, March for a Clean Energy Revolution. That's www.cleanenergymarch.org. You can go there for all the information. Again, that is a march that starts on Sunday, July 24th, this 2016, obviously, and it begins at Philadelphia City Hall. If you go to the website, you can see some of the maps and how the thing's going to be organized and what the agenda is. You can also go to dncactioncommittee.com, right? If you go to dncactioncommittee.com, you're going to find a list of all the activities, all the events, all the actions that will be taking place in Philadelphia all throughout this week. Because it's not just Sunday, it's just one day or another, but if you just take a quick peek at the calendar, and these are folks, you know, again, this is where it is connected to Occupy Philly, because Occupy Philly is the folks that are kind of keeping up on this calendar. They've put out an amazing calendar, which showing you just how much stuff is going on. It's going to be pretty amazing. There's going to be a beginning on Monday. Bernie Sanders is slated to speak on Monday. Beginning on Monday, there's an organization that is going to be setting up the protest. Let me just kind of get it for you real quickly. This is the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign has got a march on Monday at 3 p.m. called March for Our Lives. And they're going to be setting up a shantytown, basically an FDR park down in Philadelphia called Clintonville, right? And they're going to be building and occupying that space. So it's going to be quite some time outside the Philly convention. I can't wait to see all the actions going down. So if you're in the Philadelphia area, or you can get to the Philadelphia area, you're connected up with these movements, please, please come out and look for us. Look for my hat. So Raging Chicken Press on my hat. I'll have my media equipment down there, and I would love to talk with you. So Sean, do you have any, you know, kind of looking ahead to the actual DNC convention, any thoughts on what to expect? Anything interesting happening inside the walls of the Philadelphia Convention Center?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I haven't been paying attention to what's going to go on with the convention. I'm more excited about what's going to be happening outside of the convention, where the movement's actually going to be. Mm-hmm. You know, I think obviously Clinton's going to be the nominee. That's pretty much apparent. I like that she's giving space to Bernie Sanders to speak. I will be working all day on Monday, but I am really looking forward to watching Bernie Sanders' speech when I get out of work, because I think his speech is going to be like that Ted Kennedy speech, the dream will never die type of, like that. I think he's going to bring that type of speech to the convention floor.
Yeah, and I think there's a bunch of folks that are, you know, one of these things that's hanging in the air is whether or not Bernie Sanders is going to make an appearance outside the convention hall too as well, to kind of speak to supporters and people that are part of that movement. So that's going to be something that's going to be interesting to watch too as well.
Sanders,
I'm kind of interesting to see over the course of the week just how the Democratic Party is going to attempt to either acknowledge and give a spotlight of you know, kind of worker-centric politics on that platform, or how they're going to paper over the stuff that's come up in that movement to make way for a more centrist Clinton. I'm very curious to see how they're going to try to frame the VP choice now that it looks like Elizabeth Warren is clearly out of the running. Well, I shouldn't say I know that, but at least from some of the reporting that's been out there.
It looks like she's going to pick a boring centrist Democrat from Iowa or something like that, which frankly I think is the wrong choice to make.
Yeah, absolutely.
The party is going to the left. The establishment is going to – the establishment is where it's at. But the people inside the party are going – we are moving further and further to the left. And I really use this pick as a way to transition the party into that progressive realm where the party's actually heading to the base. But instead, it looks like she's going to pick a moderate DNC or DLC Democrat who is in bed with big business. And it's just like she needs an inspiring pick. And I think the two candidates, Vilsack and Tim Kaine, are not the most inspiring people in the world.
No, I mean, you got Tim Kaine, who's known as, he got a lot of press and he's been seen as a kind of an upcoming, leader in the Democratic Party under that DLC banner, because in part he's kind of been part of the process of getting Democrats elected in Virginia. So you got Senator Tim Kaine, Virginia. He's one of those people. And then Tom Vilsack, the former secretary or agricultural secretary, again, not exactly as you said, not the people that are going to light a fire.
Who's this? Like, I would like to see, if anyone, Thomas Perez from the NLRB, from the Department of Labor. I would love to see him become vice president.
Well, I was really surprised. I mean, he was actually one of the folks that was in the running, right? It was being vetted for the process. And, who knows why that exactly took place or why he didn't go with it. But I'm surprised that they would let it slip or let it leak that it's going to be Kaine or Vilsack at this point. Who knows what they're going to do, but it's almost like the mirror of the Republican and Democratic Party is that you got Donald Trump, instead of going with the guy who's going to be right, be the warrior for him. Chris Christie, they pick the, freaking pastiest, whitest guy you could possibly get, who's also extraordinarily boring. You got Mike Pence out there from Indiana, whose only reason I think he was on the VP list to begin with, because Republicans knew that he was going to lose the governorship, but whatever. But that was on the Republican side, long said that, that was, the one to appease the establishment. And I think that's the same thing that's happened with Clinton, is that, it's like the mirror image of it. It's like, is Tim Kaine a horrible human being like Chris Christie is? No. Right. But does he reflect at all the progressive values that we've seen that came out of the Bernie Sanders campaign? No. Right. So instead, we get the placeholder in the VP slot instead of someone that could actually represent, these
movements. Elizabeth Warren, Hillary Clinton, Elizabeth Warren ticket would be phenomenal.
Yep.
I mean, like, you know what I mean? Like, that would just be phenomenal having. But also, I am kind of glad Elizabeth Warren's not in the VP race, because she needs to stay in the Senate. She is going to be the counterbalance to Chuck Schumer in the Senate.
No, I agree.
And that's where we need her most.
I don't know. I think she could – I wouldn't say that that's where we need her most. I think that the fact that she's there is not a bad thing, that she will actually have a significant impact on what goes on.
Yep. No, I agree.
So we'll listen. Well, all right. So we got the DNC is coming up this week in Philadelphia. Looking forward to that. We're going to take a little break. When we come back after that, we're going to talk, we're going to talk a little Pokemon Go. We're going to talk a little coffee, and we'll talk a little beer. All right. We'll be back right after this to close out this week's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be right back. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 5 years, we've brought unapologetic progressive activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond.
We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work. We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism, and frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a good beer or a cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support, and keep up the fight. Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. With Out the Coop, each week we check in with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, on the good, the bad, and the ugly. This Harrisburg, PA, and politics in the USA, man. Man, so it's been a heavy, convention kind of discussion week. And so we're going to close out today, just as we usually do, just kind of little fun tidbits here and there. So, Sean, have you been Pokemoning?
No, I have not.
You have not.
I have not even considered downloading the game.
Have you seen people Pokemon going?
Yes. A bunch of my coworkers actually were standing in the back a couple days ago on their cell phones playing Pokemon because the delivery drivers, because of one of the delivery drivers made Isles of Hampton Pizza Boy a a lore or a place for an outpost for Pokemon Go. So we actually have customers coming in playing the Pokemon game as they are drinking beer and eating pizza. It's actually
go ahead, sorry.
So I am one of these people that I don't stay up with the times intentionally. I am a traditionalist. I don't not stay up with the times and do this stuff. I see it as a fad. And good, you can have your fun with your little smartphone and waste tremendous amounts of data. And go ahead, go do that.
There you go. So you're a hater. So yeah. I'll tell you what.
Go out there and wreck your family plan, your data plan.
Yeah, well, you got that, right? That is true. But here's the kind of interesting thing about it, right? So I first heard about this. Obviously, it's broke on the news and stuff. And I was like, what is this thing? But then my kid, when my son came home, he's seven, he came home from his summer camp thing and he started talking about it and, making the demand, doing the, dad, come on, can I get this? And I'm like, I did some reading up on it and I saw there's some issues with, concerns about privacy that, you've got, what's his face? God, from Minnesota, L, what's guys, the senator from Minnesota. Why am I forgetting his name? Al Franken. Al Franken was going to have some hearing or something like this on the privacy issues and what they're using with data and that kind of stuff. So, there was a bunch of concerns. So we just said, no, you're not going to do this, right? And especially, as I took a swim with my phone last week or a week and a half ago, which basically wrecked my phone. And the phone that I was using was an old Samsung S3 and this could not load the game, could not handle it. So I said, no, we're not going to do it. Well, I finally got a new phone and, my kid had been talking about it. And so I checked it out. I said, okay, look, here's the rule. All right. If you want to see what the game is like, right, we'll download it. When I get my new phone, we'll download the app. But the rule is you only do it with me. Right. And so he's like, okay, agreed to that. Right. My daughter was all excited too, as well, because both of them love Pokemon. Right. The cards and all that kind of stuff and the TV show, whatever. What was interesting about it is so we went out on Tuesday night. I got my new phone kind of loaded up, went out on Tuesday night and we just kind of walked. We were out walking for like 2 hours. Right. I can't get my kids to go out and go for a walk for me for like an hour unless like every once in a while I can. Right. Them to go to the park with me sometimes and stuff like this. But we were out and kind of walking all over the place looking for these like crazy, stupid little Pokemon. Right. On the phone. So that was kind of interesting. And there was also some things along the way, right? That there's markers, landmarks of different historical markers and things like this in the town. So I got to talk about that stuff with the kid. There's a World War II memorial there. There's a baseball field. And we talked about the construction of the baseball field. So it was actually kind of had a different perspective on it. I said, one, there I'm out outside. Instead of them wanting to play a video game or things like this, we're out actually walking around outside as a family, on this long walk and kind of checking out things in the town. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And I started reading then some of the, you know, the hate stuff, you know, why Pokemon Go is everything that is wrong with late capitalism. There's that article that's circulating out there. Exactly. And things like that. Right. Well, yeah, I know. Exactly. And I've read that. Right. And I said, but you know what? I'm not in the hater group. And I thought it was interesting. So I was at a meeting yesterday, a union meeting. And as you know, that at AppScuff, my union, we're without a contract for over a year now. And basically, we're preparing for the event of a strike come the fall. And I'm our mobilization chair at my university, which basically coordinates strike efforts and that kind of thing. So we have these weekly mobilization meetings, information and stuff. And so we're talking about some of the actions that are coming up that we're planning for the fall. And somebody's there. I don't want to out them online, but somebody was there and was basically said, we should put Pokemon stops on this map, right? And at first I laughed, right? And he said, no, I'm serious. Right. I said, that's kind of interesting. And he said, people are going to be playing that game anyways. I thought, you know, that's kind of interesting. He was like, I'm going to go look into it. I'm going to look at some stuff. So awesome. Go ahead. Let's do it. And then I came home and the Pokemon Go servers were down yesterday. So I was trying to figure out, is there like somebody out there who tells you whether the servers are down or just my phone or whatever. And I came across this article in These Times. We've also plugged in this in this podcast already today by Kate Aronoff. Right. And it's an article. It's called Will Pokemon Go Help Activism Evolve? And it's a really good read. Right. She, in that article, she's already talking about how people are already using this app to facilitate organizing, right? Because basically, for those people who haven't played it, is basically, you know, you're going around with this app looking for these little Pokemon and these little markers on the map that you can go to kind of charge up or to kind of train your little Pokemon critters and things like that. But so people go to those sites, right? Those are predictable places where people who are playing this game will go. And so there's activists, particularly around the environmental movement, that are using these as a way of kind of organizing and consolidating people. And there's ways, as you said before, with Pizza Boy, you can put a lure in that basically brings kind of the rare Pokemon there, so more people will kind of come in search of that. What's interesting about it is there's some actions for some environmental groups that are kind of putting lures around fracking sites, for example, right? Oil rigs and this kind of stuff that are trying to mobilize actions around there. So my point of that is not that like Pokemon Go is great. That's not the point. But the thought behind this in this article, why I wanted to plug it a little bit today, is just because it's about a mentality, right? Instead of it being about, you know, I am holier than thou and I pass judgment on these things about whether it is good or bad, right? The question from activists, right, from the activist kind of angle of things, right, from the organizer angle of things, like, oh, you've got this new thing that is emerging. Is there any potential? Is there anything that we can do to use this as a way to kind of like, you know, organize around, right? It doesn't mean it solves problems long term or changes a lot of stuff, but it's a way of kind of tapping into things that are going on in our culture right now that can be used for our kind of organizing. So I thought that was really, really freaking cool, right? At the same time, I get to, you know, go out and hang out with my kids and go for walks and looking for little Pokemon. It's kind of fun.
That's great.
So, but I get it. You're gonna stay down there with your, you know, oh, my data plan, right? Really, what is just want to be a, you want to be a kind of old school snob, I guess. Sorry.
Yeah. So, you have something else you want to talk about? Some coffee?
Yeah. So check this out.
Okay. So you're becoming more of a hipster, I hear, right?
Well, sort of, right? So I got two things, right? So I the first. Is that in the Brewcast, right, which we're doing with Matthew Beniak, right, he's bottling a Belgian strong ale, right, as part of the Brewcast, right? So he's going through the home brewing process and all this. And if in his words, if it turns out okay, he's going to call this recipe that, you know, this is his original recipe, he's going to call this recipe the Raging Belgian. Right. So out of that collaboration, we're going to get a beer named after us for the first time, which is freaking awesome. But for a while back, I was just kind of, you know, one of the things I would love to do here at Raging Chicken. And this is for all our listeners out there. If you got any ideas, you got connections, let me know. And to see if I could partner with, a local, at least somewhere in Pennsylvania or the region, coffee roaster that did fair trade stuff and organic stuff, and see if they'd be willing to partner with us and to have like a Raging Chicken roast, right, that we could use for our own promotion, help raise a little funds, but also support local business. So I was doing some kind of research online, and I came across this really, really awesome place called It's called Steel Cup Coffee Roasters out there in Pittsburgh, and they do fair trade stuff. They do it's all organic stuff, and it's got a small family that got this started. Really cool story behind it. So you know, I just ordered some of their coffee, but the cool thing was they have a special release, which was this. Right. For those of you who are watching on video right now, you can see this. It is a whiskey barrel aged coffee that is awesome. And it's the kind, it's so awesome that it actually feels like in the morning you pour yourself a cup, it feels kind of wrong drinking it, right? Because the whiskey taste is so strong. So so I'm by no means the person that goes out and kind of like looks for all like my craft coffees and stuff, like I do with some of the craft beers, thanks to Sean and you know, Kitchen over here.
So wait, what you're telling me is you're not opening up a can of Sunny Side Up or a bourbon barrel Sunny Side at 6:30 in the morning.
No, I'm drinking my whiskey roasted coffee right now. And the other thing is that our office manager with my union, my local union, she loves coffee, right? And it's my belief that, you know, and she's like total freaking activist, environmentalist, right? You know, she's strong. She's awesome. She loves coffee too as well. And it's my belief that you know, got to keep the most important people in your organization happy. So so I said I brought her a bunch of that stuff too as well. So, so that's that. So yeah. So, you know, check it out. You know, I think it's always a good move to kind of promote local businesses, especially when they're doing it right. So kind of check them out. Whiskey Barrel Aged Coffee, and this is Steel Cup Coffee Roaster. So, and no, they did not pay me to say that, right? I wish they would. I wish anybody would, for all the stuff we mentioned, the stuff today, but, yeah, it's pretty good. So check that out. So yeah. So Sean, anything else going on? Kind of fun stuff in your world?
You know, beer wise, Pizza Boy's gonna be canning again next week. I don't know which beers are going to be canning, but it's gonna be really interesting to see how fast these fly out of here. Our Sunny Side Up release went really well. Our allotment inside the store sold out within like 5 days.
So can I ask you a question about that? So yeah, because I remember you talking about how fast that sold out. We talked about that in last week's podcast. So did they were they already planning the second round of canning, or was it kind of say, oh, we'll do this, we'll see what it's like, and they said, okay, no, we're gonna do this.
No, I think the goal is for them to can once a month at least.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
So it's gonna bring a lot more people in, and because of that, I am actually I've spent it's been a little rocky the past 6 months. With going to vacation, actually having to pay taxes this year. And I had got my finances back in order within the past few weeks because of how busy we've been this summer. Mm-hmm. I've had the opportunity to like build up my savings again back before, from last year. So it's a life lesson. Really like shows you how long it takes actually to get your stuff back in order from one job to another, even though I was literally hired like 2 days after I was let go with the show. But like that year, amazing, it took like 8 or 9 months to do that. And when I was working with the Rick Smith Show, I was trading beer, and I am now back up and doing that again, especially with the releases going on. I'm trading. I'm working out a trade right now with someone from Austin, Texas, to get some beer from Jester King.
Where is that?
Jester King is a farmhouse. It's a farmhouse brewery. Mm-hmm. In Austin, outside of Austin, they do nothing but farmhouse ales. That's what they specialize in some sours. They do some IPAs and stouts like that, but they're primarily a sour, farmhouse ale brewery. And what they do is they forge their own yeast or their own wild yeast from the actual farm.
That's awesome.
So they came up with their own culture of yeast from that area. From that to the region, and I'm going to be getting a couple of really good Brett sours, a blueberry sour, which I'm really looking forward to, and like an old Bruin, which is like a red Flemish ale. So I'm really looking to expand that stuff and build up like a collection of beers in my closet of different like bottles to try.
Yeah. Hey, can I ask you like a hi, I'm a craft beer dummy question. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean, right? The designation, like, say, you're a farmhouse brewery, right?
Yes.
Does that mean something specific, or is it, I mean, because I know that you have to have a farm, but are there kind of like rules around that?
Not really. Mm-hmm. So one of the best breweries, what's considered one of the best breweries in the country, is Hill Farmstead in Vermont. I think it's somewhere in northern Vermont. I don't know exactly where, but what Hill Farmstead is, it's literally a farmhouse barn where he brews on site, Sean Hill, and he's considered one of the best breweries in the world, especially for craft. The farmhouse style just means that it's used with wild
yeast. So
you're not using lager or ale yeast. You know, ale yeast and lager yeast are your two main dominant forms of yeast, but they're using wild yeast that's from the open air. And what that does is it gives it more of a funkier, sour taste. You have Brettanomyces, which is a yeast strain, right? And then you have Lactobacillus, which is actually a bacteria.
Right.
And what Lactobacillus does is that gives it a sour taste. Where, like, you're getting a straight sour taste. Brett will give you a sour taste, right? Brettanomyces. But it also keeps on fermenting while it's in the bottle. So while you have this sour beer that – so, for instance, best way to explain it, Planet of Dreamers from Intangible Ales was just released at Pizza Boy last week. Apricot sour, 100% Brett beer. That beer has been sitting in that bottle for 2 years now, carbonating and fermenting. And the Brettanomyces will keep on fermenting until you open up the bottle. So the taste of the beer changes a lot from 2 years ago to now. So if you sit on those bottles for two more years, you'll actually, the beer might be tasting completely different because you don't know how the Brettanomyces will, it's just something you don't know what will happen. So you're taking a risk. Will it go bad? Will it not go bad? Will it taste like vinegar or not? But you're how much more funkier will it get? Like last night, I opened up a Juxtapose, which was released like last, I'm going to say August. So it's a year old. I have two of them left. So that's why whenever you buy the farmhouse ales, you buy three or four, put them aside, drink one now, drink one 6 months ago, 6 months later, and just see how that beer changes down the road.
Cool.
Yeah.
So that's – no, thanks. You know, one of the reasons I asked, you remember last week I was talking about the Woodland Hop Farm and Fermentation up there in Marcy, New York, one of the places I got to see on my vacation. And they call themselves a farmhouse brewery and, you know, just do great stuff, like a lot of farmhouse ales and stuff. But they came back and they kind of commented on our podcast and some of our posts, and, you know, thanks for the plug and that kind of stuff. And they kind of see themselves as that. So it's a place got to get up there again.
Locally in the Philadelphia area, a place I absolutely love, one of my favorite all-time places is Forest in Maine in Ambler, which is a suburb outside of Philadelphia in Montgomery County. And basically, if you're not from the area, it's basically pretty much the Fort Washington exit of the on the turnpike if you're traveling across the state.
Is it on the train line?
Yes, it is. It's right. It's literally like two blocks away from the train station. So it's easy to get to. There's public transportation going there. So if you're going out from the city, you can catch a train there and catch a train back within reasonable hours.
Right. I just want to say, so put a plug in for all those folks that are coming out to the Democratic National Convention for, you know, activism or delegates, whatever there. Why don't you kind of hop on a line and get out to Ambler and check out Forest in Maine.
And what they do is they also have their own yeast foraged from a local community garden, where they forage their own yeast from Ambler. Pennsylvania, which is pretty cool. And you use that for all beers. So different types of yeasts and wild ales, you'll get completely different tastes depending on what you get. So I'm really looking forward to it. Schooling you guys a little bit on
different. No, I appreciate it. You know, again, like, you know, I think it's fascinating stuff.
One of the cool things is this whole entire subculture of beer people there's a trading subculture. What you do is you get your beers. You have to have a lot of trust because sometimes you'll get burned in a trade and it sucks, but you gotta trust the person you're trading with and that they're going to follow through. And usually the way you do it is you come up with your trade, I'll send you X, Y, and Z. You give me this, that, and the other. And then when you ship out the box, what you do is you exchange tracking numbers.
Right.
So you can actually like, hey, here's your tracking number. Boom. Yep. It's going to get to you in like 3 or 4 days. So it's a really great subculture out there, and it's going to be really interesting. Just seeing how far, you know, there's a big demand within our beer scene for a lot of Pizza Boy beers, and, you know, I don't mind making some trades.
No, that's awesome. So, well, you know, when you get that next trade in, we said, oh, you got to let us know about what you got and kind of what you think. So that's pretty cool. So listen, we've gone on today, but in a good way.
Man, like 2 hours. We've been.
Yeah, at least we've been talking. Yeah, because we've been, you know, the whole podcast won't be 2 hours, but because
we've been talking for over 2 hours.
Yeah, we've been talking for a while. So, but it's good. So, just so everybody knows, next week we may try. Sean and I are kind of bouncing around the idea of trying to do this kind of live. Like, instead of doing this, well, we're doing this live now, but. We're talking to each other live, at least the podcast comes up later, but actually be sitting in the same room and actually doing this podcast because he's going to be coming back to the area. So so we'll see. Look out for that. We'll let you know what we're going to do with this. If we can swing it, if it works out, we might even do the show live where you can kind of join in and comment and things like this. But we'll see. We'll see what kind of prep that we could do ahead of time. And what we can do for mic setups and that kind of stuff. So so we'll check it out there. Maybe. So look it out.
We could probably even do it on Facebook Live. You can watch us on Facebook too.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I was thinking about Facebook Live and, you know, as a way, you know, I have to figure out kind of the like setup and mics and things like that. The microphone is one that's kind of just got me thinking the most about it. But we'll get to that down the road. But anyway, so look for that next week. We'll see if we can make that happen. Yeah, it's been a good one. So for those of you who are going out to the DNC in Philadelphia, this coming week, please, you know, look for a Raging Chicken Press hat. We'll be out there. Love to talk with you. Love to kind of do a little interview with you on Facebook Live stuff. I'll try to bring as many extra batteries and chargers as possible to keep it going. I'm going to try to travel pretty light since I'm going to take the train in most likely. Parking is supposed to be pretty horrific right around the convention area. They're blocking off a bunch of areas. So public transportation is always beneficial anyways. And if you're out there on Sunday for the March for the Clean Energy Revolution, please check me out. I'll be up and down the aisles or up and down the march talking to folks. All right. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. And this is going to bring Out to Coop podcast to a close for this July 21st. So, Sean, we'll talk to you next week, man.
All right. Talk to you later.
All right, we're out of here. See ya!